Our next panel, the investor's perspective. This is one worth listening to. It's going to be moderated by my colleague Jim Sorenza, who runs our equity and fixed income sales desk in North America. Jim, come on up and introduce your panelists.
Thank you.
And we're just waiting for David Marcus now.
Hey!
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here and welcome to the investor panel. I've done investor panels over many, many years, and I haven't seen a group this happy in a while. Anyway. We have James Berner from BlackRock. We have Richard Diamond from Castlewood. We have J.P. Gagan from GVI, Global Value Investors. David Marcus, kind of Evermore, but mostly the Price Family Office. And Bob Robotti from Robotti & Company. So, James, I'll start with you. I'll give each one of you a chance to tell a little bit about your fund.
Yeah, sure. First of all, thanks for inviting me, and good to be here. Hopefully we can keep you guys alert this late in the afternoon. So I'm a managing director partner with BlackRock's Diversified Infrastructure Fund. That is a private, long-dated equity infrastructure fund that invests pretty broadly across infrastructure, hence the name Diversified. One of those areas is shipping, but I also look at power generation, LNG, and some other areas. Most of you would know us as the fund that took GasLog private, so that's one of our larger investments. We raise a series of closed-end, multi-billion-dollar private equity infrastructure funds. We're almost finished raising our fourth fund, which is a $6 billion fund. GasLog was out of our $5 billion fund in 2021. In terms of how we think about shipping, it's a specific niche, right? We're looking generally, or a 12-year fund, looking at fairly sizable opportunities, often partnering with corporates or operators to invest on a long-term basis. That can be in shipping, that can be in transportation, that can be in storage, that can be in power generation, natural gas pipelines, many other things. So give some other examples of what we've done in the space. We have a structured investment into Crowley's Alaska Fuels business. We have a partnership with Vopak where we own Dow Chemical's marine terminals in the U.S. Gulf of Mexico. We used to have a partnership around FPSOs. So I guess the common thing is we're looking for regulated or chartered revenues from the majority of what we do, which obviously limits to some extent what we do in shipping.
Richard.
Yes. I'm the principal of Castlewood Capital. I manage money for a few high net worth individuals and my family. We're a generalist fund. My goal is to produce alpha and not to become poor. And like Willie Sutton, who was asked, why did he rob banks? Because that's where the money was. I'm heavily weighted to shipping equity and debt because that's where I can find among the best risk reward in equity and debt today.
JP.
Thanks, Jim. And it's a pleasure to be up here with so many distinguished investors. Global Value Investment Corp is a long-only separate account manager. We have a go-anywhere mandate. We're fundamental, bottoms-up, value-oriented. We have a long-term time horizon, which we generally define as 5+ years. Oftentimes, it's on the far right side of that plus. And we're concentrated. Of the 18 equity securities we own right now, five are in shipping or shipping-adjacent industries. We feel that that's driven out performance and reduced our correlation to indices over the past couple of years. From a philosophical standpoint, we very much view equity ownership as not a piece of paper to be bought and sold, but really an ownership interest in an operating entity. And as such, it's important for us to understand how the companies in which we invest operate or work. Obviously, there's a quantitative aspect to that, which is relatively straightforward. We spend a lot of time on the qualitative aspect of that, which often boils down to understanding management and capital allocation policies. Simplistically, in a business, you really have management standing between the cash flows generated by the productive assets of a business and the realization of the value of those cash flows by investors. And capital allocation is the mechanism or set of mechanisms that management employs to accomplish that. There's no magic formula to capital allocation. We see many different capital allocation strategies deployed quite effectively by a number of different companies. But our job is to comb through the many, many good companies that we come across and find the really great investments. And almost without fail, that necessitates a well-developed, well-communicated capital allocation policy, and especially in an industry as cyclical and volatile as shipping, I think capital discipline is paramount and can really make or break an investment.
David.
Thanks, Jim. And Nicholas, thank you for inviting me as well. My name is David Marcus. I run Evermore Global Value Fund. We are a mutual fund that can invest anywhere in the world, in any sector. We're just opportunistic investors. In addition to Evermore, I also manage the Price Family Office, which is the family office for Michael Price, who was sort of a big Wall Street guy over the last 30 years. Unfortunately, Michael passed away last year. And then I merged my asset management business into the asset management business of the family. So I run the family office as well. We started investing in maritime-related investments back in late 2015. In fact, I think it was at a conference here. And back then, it was not as rosy and robust and incredibly sexy as it is today. But it looked like it was the end of the world. And it was one of the greatest periods of time, it turns out, because it looked like death and devastation walking through the place here. So obviously, the industry's come a long way. We've navigated it, I think, reasonably well. And we just like to take advantage of the various opportunities across the whole space, both for our fund and potentially for family capital as well over time.
And Bob.
Hi, I'm Bob Robotti. We run an asset management firm. We manage close to $1 billion U.S. We are long-term buy and hold kind of investors, definitely looking for assets and businesses we think are beaten up and out of favor, and therefore the entry point is far below what it would cost to build that business. The nature of shipping is such that frequently that does happen. You can buy assets far below what the replacement value of it is, and those are assets that are valuable, and that replacement value is of relevance. The main focus over the years we've gravitated to, though, is energy, and that's fossil fuels, and that's primarily what I do. And in addition to have the long viewpoint, what that also means is frequently we get involved with companies and do sit on the boards because we think there's a very long-dated opportunity where the assets are very far below what they're worth. The opportunity for consolidation and improvement in the business is dramatic, and therefore do play a role and sit on the board and give away the chance to buy and sell and trade around, because we don't trade around the positions anyway, but it gives us the opportunity to continue to deploy capital as the situation unfolds and the opportunity plays out. Today, I do sit on the boards of three of the companies in which we're investors in. Two of those are energy companies. So it's an industry that I've invested for a long time. And of course, shipping and energy have a lot of common points and kind of more today, because there are two asset classes out there, LNG and LPG, which probably didn't really exist or were anywhere near the size businesses they are today. So the cross-section of those businesses are many different places.
I'm going to ask a few of you to tell me a little bit more about your investment process. You know, David, for years we've known you at Mutual Series, and we knew you at Evermore, and now you're taking over the Michael Price family office. How does that change the spectrum of what you look at now and how you make investment decisions going forward?
I guess it's really in a number of ways. When you're running an equity portfolio or a mutual fund portfolio and some managed accounts, you're focused on the equity side of the opportunity, and maybe the preferreds. Once in a while, you might look at some piece of debt, but it's really small. When you have capital from a family office, you have more, I'll call it permanent, at least long-term capital that can be have a different level of patience. And so if the equity opportunity is sort of some couple of slices of a pie, when you have the opportunity that's this larger opportunity, you get more of the slices of the pie. You could look at privates. You could look at partnering with some of the families. You could look at other opportunities. And so the key is to sit back, do absolutely nothing, and just get to know the players, the opportunities, and hopefully over time the phone starts to ring. That's not an invitation for people to start calling. But hopefully the phone starts to ring and you get shown various opportunities that in the past we couldn't even say, let's have a meeting, because it was wasting everybody's time. So that flexibility is incredible. It doesn't mean we have to do anything. It just means we have more opportunity to take advantage of the changing environment, which, as we know, this is an industry that changes quite rapidly, regardless of what we think will happen. We've all learned that it doesn't always happen that way, especially when all the stars line up, usually something goes the other way. But that usually gives us opportunities. So I'm excited as we get to this juncture that we can now look at a much broader swath across the whole spectrum.
And James, we know you primarily because of your exposure with GasLog. Tell us more about the investment process within your fund.
Yeah, I guess similar to what he just said, I mean, I think, again, we don't make a lot of investments. We make fairly large investments, so they're all probably over $250 to $500 million. And they're all ones we intend to hold, you know, we can hold them up to 10 years. And most of them come from partnerships we have with companies or develop. So I'll use GasLog as an example. I could use others. I started talking to the company roughly 2015. We talked about a whole number of different ways for us to invest, be they potentially convert preferreds. We talked about a joint venture in the FSRU space. You know, I got to know the company very well. I got to know Peter pretty well. And ultimately just, you know, sort of stayed in touch around where we could put money to work, because we come from an energy background. We came out of First Reserve. We understand energy markets, and we really had a very fundamentally positive long-term view on natural gas and LNG. And moving it to Asia requires more ships when it comes out of the United States. So, you know, that led to the discussion around the take private being in 2020, which ultimately led to a transaction in 21. So in terms of the formal process, you know, it's pretty typical in terms of, I won't go through the how we do our diligence and committees, but most of what we've done is generally on a relationship basis, negotiated situations. I'll pick on the Dow Chemical deal. Dow has a tremendous amount of terminaling and short rail infrastructure in the U.S. Gulf. It's really important to it, but it doesn't need all of it to sit on its balance sheet. And it was quite happy to have an experienced partner like us, but also like Vopak, who can manage it for them. So they provide us a long-term kind of minimum volume contract, which makes it infrastructure. And they sold it to us, and so we now own it and manage it on their behalf. So hopefully that gives you some sense of how we come about these kinds of investments.
And Bob, we had a fun conversation last week, and so some people in the room will know you from being the second largest shareholder of Tidewater, which I know you can't talk about because you're on the board and you're in the quiet period now. But you've been involved in shipping investments going back to the 1980s, and one thing you said with me that stuck with me is you're really good at losing money in the short term.
Well, we do. We have a very long timeline, and frequently when you're looking to buy things that are beaten up and out of favor, you never pick the bottom of that bottom point. Things get worse, and of course, my experience has really been the things that I made the most money in are the things that worked against me initially. Because what happens in that process is there's already a cathartic process, consolidation, people leaving the business, and therefore fewer people, and better opportunities. The longer it takes for the recovery to happen, the better the opportunity is on the upside, and the bigger the upside potential is. And so I think that Tidewater, that company, is an example. But everything in that business, everything in the offshore energy service business, today, I think, is extremely interesting because the assets trade far below replacement cost. The idea that someone's going to build new assets is still long dated. The rates today don't justify new buildings, so therefore that risk is diminished, which is a repeated pattern across many businesses, including some of shipping. And so therefore, you could buy assets for 30% of what they're worth. You can buy strong balance sheets, and you can buy these businesses not only for much less than what the replacement cost is, and those assets are in high demand today and limited supply, but when the cash flows have already started to improve, and that's what it is once the cash flow happens, as in all these asset-heavy businesses with intensive assets, all that free cash flow incremental is all free and available. So the idea that, you know, many businesses, definitely in offshore energy, trade for cash flows for the next 3-4 years. And so therefore the price at which you pay is extremely discounted, and the likelihood of continued improvement is there. In addition, having been an investor in the energy business offshore, the energy, and I say energy business because everybody's calls it the oil business. It's not the oil business. As Chevron said today, we're an energy company because natural gas is as much as what they produce. Natural gas is a key component. Natural gas gives a different dimension to the oil and gas business than people historically have. It's not the price of oil, which is volatile all the time. LNG prices and LNG demand has a different nature to it. Onshore natural gas consumption has a different market to it. No matter what happens to prices, things in places like Egypt or Israel, they develop those fields because of onshore displacement of imported energy, so therefore much cheaper. So the volatility in the business that actually submit is less than historically has been in energy, given the broad-based nature of the demand, the increasing demand for all of it, and all of it's in tight supply. And what that also means is all of shipping, I think, is really well positioned from the point of view. I just spent a week in Chile looking at copper mines. The idea that energy is in tight supply and the world's needs for it is growing, that means renewables are really part of the equation. But yet to build out renewables means a huge amount of steel, concrete, copper, you name the metal, and it's got to move from someplace to someplace else. So the demand over the longer period of time, and that's what it is. We take a 5-year-plus timeline in terms of how we invest. And therefore, you can get conviction on what the world's going to look like in 5 to 10 years, I really do think. And a lot more than, I don't know what next quarter is going to be, I don't know what next month. All I know in energy, I said, invested energy all my life. The one thing I know about energy when they say is, what's the price of oil going to be in 6 months' time? I have no idea, except if everybody's sure it's going to be one thing, it'll be the other. That's the only thing I know. They'll all be wrong.
All right, we're going to switch topics now. So for the past year, maybe even year and a half, U.S.-listed companies have enjoyed a valuation premium over European and even Asian-listed companies. Part of that gets explained away by the massive amounts of index money that's here in the U.S. market. But Richard and JP, you both manage wealthy individual money. Can each one of you talk about the headaches of buying non-U.S. securities? Why don't we start with Richard?
Well, I'm not that bright. And there are only so many decisions that I can get right. And in shipping, you have to decide on whether or not you like the management, whether you like the segment, whether you like the macro, and lastly, what's going to happen to the NOK versus the dollar. And there's only so many things that I'm going to get right. I may get the management, I may be too early. I may get the cycle wrong, I may get the cycle right and get the management wrong, I'll still make money. I don't want to spend any time focusing on the relationship of the kroner to the dollar.
JP.
Yeah, Jim, like you said, because we're a separate account manager, all of the stock we buy needs to end up in a U.S. account in U.S. dollars. So, of course, it's easiest for us to buy U.S.-listed companies. But that, in fact, defines the investment universe of a lot of investors, institutional and non-institutional alike. So we feel that going to foreign markets both expands our investment universe and provides some degree of differentiation. Frankly, settling international transactions is a pain. At least for us, given our structure, but the frictional effort and cost that it takes is nothing compared to the additional alpha that we've found we've been able to generate by investing in foreign markets. Perhaps the ideal situation for us is buying a foreign listed company that subsequently pursues a U.S. listing, so the valuation gap that you described then begins to close.
Jim, could I just add to that?
Absolutely.
I've been investing in Europe for 30 years, and the reality is, for at least the last 20, if you look at the valuations, Europe is ridiculously much more cheaper than the U.S. There's a lot of reasons for it, but there are bargains there, and just the cost of doing business there, it's more than worth it, because a lot of investors just say, hey, I'm an American guy or gal, and I just want to invest here, and they just don't expand their horizons to look at those same kinds of businesses wherever they happen to trade. So if you have the flexibility to go anywhere the opportunity exists, you don't have to go to crazy markets. You can go to the developed markets in Europe, and just the differential is so enormous. And so I think that that flexibility is critical to have as a tool in your tool belt when you're going around looking for ideas.
David, you're absolutely right. The long-term outcome of your investment is predicated on the cash flows of the business. And if you could buy that business for less money someplace else because the market's less efficient, intuitively, you know you will make more money. And so obviously, there's the opportunity. They're discounting those cash flows, and the cash flows will determine your outcome.
So if I could buy a dollar for 60 cents here, but I could buy that same dollar for 40 cents there or less, just that going from 40 to 60, I've just caught up to the American guy. I've made a huge return, and now I hope to go even from there. So it's to that point.
Okay, so the next question, I want to thank Richard, but I'm going to start with James. So what are we worried about today that we shouldn't be? What aren't we worried about today that we should be? Start with James.
It's a good question. I still think, even though people probably have interest rates on their mind, I still don't think we've seen all the impacts of how fundamentally the interest rate environment has changed, particularly in the United States. We've gone from virtually zero rates to very long-term, 5% plus rates. I think there's the immediate impact on the capital allocation or balance sheets of companies, but I think there's a lot of secondary impacts as to when people need to make choices, what effect it has on consumers, what effect it has on certain businesses. And I do feel like that it takes time for that fairly massive change. And we see this with any stock that's yield-based. We've seen them, at least in the renewable sector in the United States and the power sector, get pretty badly treated in the last year. So I'll give you an example. The renewables energy sector in the United States, which has been very popular and we look at and invest in, was very easy or fairly easy to raise capital because people wanted to invest in the space and saw it as a growth industry. And many of it was based on sort of a yield-focused investing thesis where the actual returns weren't necessarily all that attractive. And then suddenly what's happened is the cost of everything's gone up. And relative risk-free rates are much higher. And therefore, people say, well, wait a minute. I'm not pleased to get a 4% yield and a 7% return, even if the investment is fairly low risk. And we've seen that change pretty quickly. So I think I still am worried that we haven't really thought through or seen all the indicators that might take a year or two when someone's hedging program rolls off or when you see people having to refinance debt or raise new capital. And just the cost of our, we're seeking higher investments in everything we do, right? Because we look at the alternative, which is the debt, and we say we need to be priced well above that. And so I'm still not sure we've fully seen the impact of that in shipping and elsewhere.
Richard.
Okay. The reason why I came up with this question was I was on a Capital Link panel, I think with David, around this time 5 years ago. And the two things that I wasn't worried about was COVID and the Russian invasion in Ukraine. And those were the events that drove most of my investment activity for the last 4 years. So on that basis, I think what people are worried about that we don't have to worry about is peak conventional energy. There is no energy transition. It's energy addition. Electricity demand is up 50% since 2000. An NVIDIA chip uses as much electricity as a U.S. house. And I think we're far from peak conventional energy. On the other hand, the issue that I don't think anyone is worried about, and I'm just throwing this out, is I could see the EU potentially collapsing due to decarbonization. Germany is deindustrializing. Every time they put in place a net zero policy, they have more inflation. Living standards are declining, and at some point you could have a populist revolt.
Wow. JP, do you need me to repeat the question? Price is right.
It's a difficult question. We live in this little microcosm of the investment universe where we're very concerned about microeconomics and idiosyncratic factors. So there's nothing in particular that comes to mind, but I might answer both questions with China, which is a little bit of a black box to us, and perhaps to everybody, but I think the geopolitical risk there is real, regional or international conflict. But I also think that China is, and perhaps Southeast Asia in general, is now so tied into the global economy that separating or bifurcating the world is perhaps near impossible. I say that, but perhaps I'll be wrong. I hope not.
David.
As crazy as it may sound, I feel like this industry in general has gotten smarter over the years. And so what I mean by that is think about the panel that was on just before us. Basically, they were talking about better balance sheets, better thinking about capital allocation, more thoughtful ways of getting capital back to the shareholders, not just dividends, but stock buybacks, and a variety of other ways that they think about it. Should they be net debt free? I mean, these are phrases that you just never heard in anything related to maritime. So I think managers have realized that you don't know what's happening tomorrow. You barely know what's happening today. And so being more thoughtful, hoarding the capital, yet paying some out along the way so that you're giving something back to your shareholders who are the owners of the company. It's a balancing act. And so you see the balance sheets are getting stronger. They're being somewhat more thoughtful on building out their fleets and other ways of sort of getting the renewal done and other things related. And it's just, I think it prepares you for more negative things and more good things as well, so that you're not just boom and bust in every cycle as it's been for so many cycles before. It just seems that people are getting more thoughtful that manage these businesses, but at the same time, the scale is changing. You're seeing market caps get larger, you've seen mergers, you've seen all kinds of creative solutions, you've seen very aggressive situations like Frontline DHT a couple of years ago, Frontline International Seaways more recently, Frontline Euronav, though that's now resolved. All of those roads, of course, get to Frontline for some reason. But the fact is that you're seeing consolidation in different forms, and you're seeing more sort of things evolving out of deadlocks and standstills, and people think there's no way this is going to happen. So I think it's fascinating how it's evolving, and we don't know what will happen tomorrow, but at the same time, we never did. At these conferences over the years, you've always... my own example, in late 19, we were all teed up. We had an enormous portfolio of maritime-related, dry bulk, whatever. We were loaded to the gills, and then, of course, the pandemic... You had some other issues out there, but the pandemic started, the ports closed, and these stocks were decimated. And so it didn't matter that every star had lined up positively up to that point over the prior 2 years. It didn't matter. It was just devastation for investors. Now, eventually, within a year, it prolonged the recovery or the thesis. It did play out much later. But the fact was, it was exactly the time that you should be buying, meaning it's not buying always in great periods of time. It's taking advantage of crisis, stress, to use a bad word, shitstorms, things like that where there's just opportunities because investors go into panic mode and all they want to do is pile up their cash and run into the corner. That's usually the best period of time. It doesn't mean that in good times you shouldn't be invested. It's just that you have to be open-minded to both opportunities because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And obviously, we don't really know what we're not thinking about, or we would think about them. And so it requires just more thought. But I think also the jockeys on these horses are getting much smarter. So the horses, in case you don't know, are the assets of the companies, and the jockeys are the management teams that are running them. I just think they're just more thoughtful than they were. by and large, there's always going to be a rogue one that's not, or two or three.
So, Bob, what are we worried about today that we shouldn't be? What aren't we worried about today?
I think a pervasive opportunity that's clear and obvious is the concern about recession, whether that's recession here, whether that's recession in China. The fact of the matter is anyone who's not a speculator or a trader in stocks, but is an investor in stocks, thinks about it in a 3 to 5 year time frame. I have a pretty strong probability that if there is a recession in both of those places, and there's definitely potentially one in China today, it will be over. And therefore, you'll be on the other side of that. And therefore, that's what you need to look at and focus at. And as a result, you can buy businesses today for far less than what the business is probably worth because of those fears and concerns. And that kind of permeates a lot of shipping. There is that concern. Oh, what's going to happen? How's that going to work out? The fact of the matter is, we're going to move more goods. We're going to have fewer ships because people aren't building vessels. So there's an opportunity. Of course, I think about adjacencies. And so one of the things I loved today was listening to Navigator Holdings a bunch of different times talking about their cargoes, what they're looking to do, and ammonia, because I actually think ammonia is also fits back into that concept I have of energy, North America. North America is competitively advantaged for the next decade because energy costs in North America are much lower than the rest of the world because we have an overabundance of natural gas. That is irrefutable and will be around for a long time. So therefore, if you're in the ammonia business, you know, you're making ammonia for much less than other competitors around the world. And what that means, so you can, you know, a company that I love is LSB Industries, right? I filed on it not that long ago. Here's a company you can buy for half a replacement cost. That's what we look to do, buy businesses for less than replacement cost. Strong balance sheet, very low level of potential earnings capacity in it, and the ammonia market is one in which, as I listen to Navigator, you know, makes sense to me that the, you know, demands for, and as we talk about different fuels and whatever else, the demand for ammonia in 3 to 5 years' time and 10 years' time is going to be substantially more than it is today. And so you have a growth market, trades at a half of asset value, and trades for 4 times what its earnings potential is. What more do you ask for in a business like, and a strong balance sheet? And therefore, opportunistically looking at things, looking at doing a new project with Impex, with Volpac and other people associated with it to build ammonia, low-carbon ammonia here in America. And that's where you want to build it, just like Yara's building plants here. It's a low-cost place with a competitive advantage that will be sustainable for an awful long period of time. Therefore, the companies will generate substantial free cash flows. That myopia of thinking about recession, you ignore that fact. That's the prevalent fact.
Right? Okay, so now we're going to swing to your best ideas, really short list, like two, or best themes, since, James, you might not be able to delve into the best ideas. We'll start with you.
Counterintuitively, I don't think there's anywhere near enough money being invested in crude and refined products and infrastructure. There's two things that are kind of driving that. One is there's a whole set of investors who, you know, as you raise money from certain investors, they don't want you to invest in it. And we're obviously big fans of ESG, but I think, and this was mentioned earlier, if you just sort of start doing the math, let's just take an example. The U.S. vehicle fleet on average is, okay, does anyone know what the average age of a U.S. vehicle is? Anyone want to guess?
13 years.
Yeah, well, you guys are good. It's 12 years. At least that's the chance I looked. But so it's very old. And the point is that you, like, there's a perception out there that you won't need oil, gasoline, or refined products, that it'll tail off much more quickly than it does. And very little money or less money is going into developing it, producing it, or finding new sources of it. So all that to me indicates the existing infrastructure, particularly with high inflation, is not being replaced that quickly and will continue to be really, really important because this product is still vital to transportation in the United States, in Western Europe, but also, frankly, globally, where, you know, a lot of people still don't even yet have an automobile. So will they jump to a battery-powered car? Probably not. You'll still see a lot of, so I still think that area of infrastructure is underinvested and will continue to have a lot of long-term enduring value. I'd say the same on natural gas infrastructure. Maybe that's a little more obvious, intuitive, but I think you need natural gas because it's so flexible. And allows you in the power industry to firm renewables, and we invest in that as a thesis as well. And so I do think there's a lot longer runway for that than people might otherwise think or from what pronouncements that have been made.
Richard.
I divide my shipping opportunities into shipping as infrastructure and shipping as a commodity spot business. Shipping is infrastructure. I own SFL and Flex LNG, because they have heavily contracted books, high dividends, they're deleveraging, and if I can get paid, you know, 9 to 11% consistently for 5 years, I'm a very happy camper. When it comes to shipping as a commodity, I look for the best universe is low order book and low rates. Then I look at low order book. I like VLCCs. I like INSW. I like DHT. I like Frontline. All three have superb managements with good corporate governance. And the VLCC order book delivery for next year is one ship. So there's not going to be a lot of capacity added. And if I'm right about not being on peak energy, then they've got a lot of alpha ahead of them. I'm going to add one more thing. I look to what Bob Robotti is buying. My best pick so far, one of my best picks this year, is Tidewater. I can talk about it. He can't. I've made roughly 50% of my Tidewater investment since June. A friend of mine sent me Bob's presentation at a conference in May on YouTube. I watched it. Lois Abraki is on the board, and I have enormous respect for her. I did a lot of work on the company. You know, I'm always willing to bet on Lois. I'm always willing to bet on Bob. And Bob, thank you.
I'll buy that drink for you later on, as I promised I would.
JP.
I agree with many of the other panelists in that thematically energy investments, specifically oil and gas investments, are a pretty good place to be right now. For many years, we've seen incredible underinvestment in offshore oil and gas infrastructure, particularly offshore, and I think that's really coming back to bite us right now. There probably aren't too many places you can invest offshore that won't make you money right now. As it pertains more to shipping, we like dry bulk, particularly Capesizes. You've got a low order book, 5.2% for Capesizes. Yards are full. You're probably getting deliveries in 27, 28 now, so we don't really see a meaningful fleet expansion in the coming years. And then we think that you've got global growth coming in which China will participate, or it's already underway. We're really quite bullish over the next couple of years. As long-term investors, we're focusing on a number of different developments, including an increase of ton miles from things like iron ore coming out of West Africa instead of Australia going to China, and then eventually accelerated growth in India that I think will become a very meaningful consumer of ore. So the next several years, I think, look very good for Capesizes.
Yeah, I want to add something to that because I've also been buying dry bulk, and I want to qualify this. If I learn something differently tomorrow morning, I'm a seller. But as it stands today, I've been buying dry bulk, and if you look at the performance of the stock in a cyclical company, what you really want is crappy guidance, and the stock is flat to up. And when Golden Ocean gave crappy, disappointing guidance for the third quarter and the stock went up, I started investing more heavily in the space.
David.
I don't want to sound like I'm copying somebody else, Richard, but Frontline, DHT, the opportunity and the setup are just so good. The stocks have done well. We just continue to believe that will continue to be the case for quite some time. There will be lumps along the way. There are, always are. Also, Seaways, I think the combination of the VLs and the product tankers, I think it's. I know most people want more pure play approach. I think their combo is excellent. I think they're just set so well. I know it's only supposed to be one or two names, but I'll also say that we also like, it's not in shipping, but they are ships, Cadeler with the merger with Eneti. So these are this is a wind farm installer. I think on its own, Cadeler, exceptional. phenomenal management, great assets. The combination of the two is a powerhouse, and I don't think the market really understands what that means longer term. Those are ships that cost a minimum of $300 million, so the barrier is significant for other players. And I'd just say one more on the RoRo side, and I'll mispronounce it, Hoeg Autoliners. We really like a lot, and we think, again, the setup is excellent. And so this is an area that all of these stocks that I've mentioned today, we are deploying more and more capital, but more methodically and taking our time than we did in the past. We think we could just take our time, take advantage of the volatility.
And Bob?
I think everything in the energy space, offshore energy, whether that's the drillers, the boat companies, you know, their assets trading for 40% of replacement costs. Replacement costs is relevant. All the equipment that is capable is out working. There is no order backlog in any of these things. Rates haven't approached the level that there would be the likelihood of people entering new orders. So therefore, the win to that is a long way. And I love the comment from Simon Johnson, the CEO of Seadrill, who said the offshore drilling business is going to end up looking like the Cuban cab business. The cab's 50 years old. You rebuild the engine, you slap a new coat of paint on it, and you send it back out. People aren't going to build a $1 billion drill ship or an $800 million drill ship. It's just given the uncertainty on what's the demand for that asset 10 years from now. So the cure for high prices is always high prices, except there's a real reason to think the cure for high prices today is not high prices, because new capital is not going to come into these things for a multitude of reasons. Therefore, the extended uptime and the dramatic cash flows these companies have, and if you can get a company that's in a position to continue to consolidate, to take assets and tuck them in at far below replacement costs and far below the cash-generating ability, then that's even a better combination, because there's more opportunity for growth in those numbers too, inorganically as well as organically.
Well, that's great, and I didn't expect even to get this far in terms of questions, so I'm quite pleased that we've gotten as far as we got. I want to thank you for joining us today, and I appreciate your contributions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeff.